And it says we are live. Hello, Jim. Thanks for coming on my channel.
Good evening, Dan. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to chat with you again. We've chatted a couple times now. Well, we've chatted many times offline, but I had you on my channel not long ago, and that was awesome. And I'm glad that we're reconnecting, especially on such a fun topic.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, because this, how do you even pronounce it? I've always been saying Rychat, and then I'm watching videos, and I'm saying, is that not how you say it?
Rychat. You know, I've heard people say Rychat, but I don't believe that's how it's pronounced. But there are many, you know, I don't know if it matters as much. It's more known as the Eye of the Sahara or the Eye of Africa, and I prefer that. I say it Rychat. But some people say Rychat. It's, you know, it doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, but that's how out of it as far as that theory goes, I am. I've heard people mention it and talk about it a little bit, but I really hadn't done a whole lot of research into it until I started watching videos and looking into it a little in preparation for this. So this was good to have you on here, because it's kind of getting the info from the horse's mouth, so to speak. You're one of the leading proponents of that theory, I would say.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm certainly not the first person to come up with the theory, but I am proud to have popularized it and brought it lots of eyes and attention. I had learned of the theory from a documentary called Visiting Atlantis by a George S. Alexander and Attalus Rosen. I believe they made the documentary in 2011 or 2012. And I had came across it on another platform while investigating the topic of Atlantis. And this is back in 2018. And I came across this little known documentary. It was behind a paywall on the Gaia Network at the time. And there was only a few clips about it on YouTube, and I believe the clip with the most views had like 6,000 views. And like, so nobody was talking about it. No one really knew of it. I later came to find out in more recent times that the first person that proposed the theory was an Otto Muck. And I believe this was in the late 50s or sometime in the 60s. Could have been 1970s, but I want to say 1958. I have the book near me somewhere. And it just gets complicated because it was initially published and then republished, so you know how the dates get thrown around. But anyway, so I came across this theory and I was blown away. I'm like, how have I never seen or heard of the Rychat structure before? It is one of the most unique geological anomalies found anywhere on Earth. And, you know, with the concentric circles, I will ask you this. When's the first time you had seen or heard of that structure?
Actually, it's kind of funny. The first time I'd heard of it, I was having a conversation with a person outside of YouTube and stuff. I was working on a guy's hot tub as an electrician, and we were talking about this is Graham Hancock, and he was like talking about how all the old maps of Antarctica are bullshit, but this Eye of the Sahara thing, now this was legit, and that was the first time I'd ever heard of it. So I looked it up a little bit then, but I just got custody of my son and didn't have a whole lot of time for
playing in the sandbox. When was this? How long ago was this?
About 9 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay, so before I had ever made videos on it.
Okay.
I suppose, well, like 2018 is what? That's only 6 years ago.
Yeah, it seems like it was about 9 years ago, but
right on.
Somewhere there.
Nice.
It might be more recent, just get going by the fact that, like you said, there's so few views before you had talked about it, so it's possible that... it's possible that I've got my dates mixed up. I didn't have much time to do any Atlantis-looking stuff. It was just all being a dad.
Right on. That's, I guess, one of the things I'm most proud about with the attention that the theory has gotten is showing people this site. And especially in the first few years after I made the initial videos on it, the comments were profoundly focused on, or what, you know, one of the idea or topics itself was the fact that people had not even heard of the Rychat structure before. And when I saw it, I'm like, how have I never seen or heard of this? This is just so unique, as I was saying a couple moments ago. And then I end up investigating it further, and I've significantly built on the theory by doing further research and investigations compared to what I had seen in the initial documentary on it. And if you ask me, I think it is by far the most likely location for the lost capital city of Atlantis. I should point out that according to, you know, Plato's tale on it, Atlantis was an empire made up of 10 kingdoms. And I'm not saying that the other 9 locations couldn't be found nearby or in the Atlantic Ocean. But when I look at the Rychat structure being made up of concentric circles, specifically 3 that would be of water, 2 of land, an opening at the south, comprising of red, black, and white color stones, an abundance of gold. A lot of people aren't aware that in Mauritania, prior to the discovery of gold in North America, Europe got most of their gold from Mauritania, which is a wild thing, as well as the abundance of elephants that once existed in Mauritania. Mountains to the north, which just so happened to be named Atlas, which Atlas was said to be the very first king of Atlantis. Now, those mountains were said to have a river flowing through them. Well, it turns out the Atlas Mountains had the Tamanrisset River that flowed from the Atlas Mountains 11,700 years ago, the same time of Atlantis, up until about 5,000 years ago is when it dried up, and it flowed either right through the Rishon or directly north of it. So it's another striking similarity. And so I definitely gravitate towards it. I will say, you know, as an honest, open-minded individual, I acknowledge that it's possible Atlantis never existed, although I do think that it did. It's possible if it existed, it's not the Rishon, but I gotta say that with the amount of details that are so specific and consequential that match this site precisely, it makes me a believer. I think that if nothing else, it's worthy of further investigation and study. And I do maintain that it is by far the most likely location. And I say that with respect because it is a heated topic. It is undoubtedly my most popular topic, but it is also the topic I get the most pushback on. You know, it's heatedly debated whether Atlantis existed in the first place. And then if it existed, many people think it would have been in the Atlantic Ocean. And if you want me to keep going on this, I can soapbox this.
Yeah, feel free to, man. I mean, I just really quickly, I watched a couple of your videos, like I was saying, getting ready for this, and I was very impressed by how many of the little details, like you said, lined up, where it was just like, well, that is kind of interesting, where it's just like one little thing, one little uncanny thing after another.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so by far, run with it.
Sure. So the other leading theory, I would say, from what I've noticed, is that a lot of people identify with the Azores and the Atlantic Ocean being the likely location. And although I would say that it's possible that those would be the sites or potential sites for some of the other nine kingdoms within the Ten Kingdom Empire, what's interesting is that Atlantis was said to be busy all day and all night with languages of people spoken all over in the marketplaces. And so when I look at the Rishon structure, when I think of busy all day and all night, I think of major metropolitan areas, whether it be Los Angeles, New York, London, whatever. And the dimensions of the Rishon are nearly identical to modern-day Paris and London. Paris and Cairo. And I find that interesting. But when it comes to people that support, you know, the capital city being in the Azores, I will say this, that is it really feasible to suggest that there was such a massive empire of people that were speaking languages from all over, conducting immense trade in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where at that time, as it's described, that Atlantis was the leader of seafaring technology. They were the ones that could do it where others couldn't. And so I find that another interesting thing, because when you look at the fact that the legend of Atlantis came out of Egypt itself, which is something that surprises people when they hear it for the first time, that the Egyptians had allegedly said that they were descendants of a destroyed civilization and Egypt was essentially the colony where they started over new. And so when I look at the fact that the Sahara Desert was green in a lush environment up until 5,000 years ago, that it was, you know, at its at the peak of Atlantis before its destruction approximately 11,600 years ago, you know, there was a massive network of rivers, the largest freshwater lake ever known to exist in Earth's known history was in the Sahara. And more recent scientific studies have come out in the last several years saying that the Sahara Desert would have been a migration area for humans, as well as vast settlements and civilizations. And they're now finding evidence of this through the use of LIDAR from space. They're finding various relics of ancient ruins throughout the Sahara, and it's very clear that people would have lived there. So if the Egyptians were to have said that they were descendants or colonists from that destroyed civilization, it's not unreasonable to suggest that Atlantis would have been in the Sahara, especially being a green, lush paradise. And I will also say this one little thing before I wrap up my soapbox. A lot of people say, well, Atlantis was described to be an island, so it couldn't possibly be the Rishon structure. Well, if you research the ancient Greek word used for island, it was used by Plato. It was Nessos and Nesson, which turned out had five different meanings, one of which was island, but others were promontory, peninsula, as well as land within a continent surrounded by lakes, rivers, or streams. And I'm like, you could argue that would describe the Rishat structure at that same period of time. And then people will also say, well, if this was the structure, where are the relics? And the key part of the theory is that the Sahara Desert was bulldozed by some sort of unknown catastrophic force of water. And when you see the salt within the Rishat structure, and let me just correct myself that in my last video on it, I suggested that there was salt in the Sahara around in front of Emi-Kusi. I was incorrect. Those are diatoms that were the remnants of the remnants of Mega Lake Chad, which has since evaporated. So that was not salt. However, there is salt indeed within the Rishat. Of course, the naysayers will say that, oh, that's just desert salt that's coming out of the stone. I don't know, man. When you look at the satellite imagery of the Rishat structure and compare it to Google Earth, where you can evaluate the elevation, the areas of the highest concentration of salt are all at the lowest elevational regions, parts of the Rishat, which I think is indicative that seawater may have settled and later evaporated there. This is hotly debated. But it's all these little details that add up that I believe make the site worthy of further study and consideration for the lost city of Atlantis.
Well, yeah, that's definitely some interesting little tidbits there. The idea that I had never heard the thing about the language. I hadn't heard that until just now, that the Greeks had five different meanings for that word and that one of them would have well described the Rishat. That's pretty crazy.
Or at least suggest that it wasn't an island. Because I will say this. When it comes to the Atlantic Ocean, is unique on Earth in that it is the most sonared and mapped ocean floor on Earth. Mostly because of the Cold War and the searching for sunken Soviet subs with nuclear missiles. And I'm just inclined to think that if there was a sunken civilization there, although it's realistic to say it'd be completely obliterated and we might not be anything left of it, it would have a higher chance of being found. Whereas if you consider the Sahara Desert, most people wouldn't consider and have never considered for even a second that it could potentially be the site of Atlantis, because it's like a desert pit. But then when you look at the scientific studies showing that it was a lush green paradise at the same period of time of Atlantis, I think it's worthy of further consideration.
Well, yeah, so many of those things are worthy of further consideration, and of course they won't get it. I mean, all we have to do is touch it, and it's apparently, you know, no longer worthy of further consideration.
Right.
Is my volume okay? I've got.
It's perfect.
Okay.
Mine is. I can hear you perfect. If you're wondering what I'm doing, it's just my earbuds keep slipping out of my ears. They don't fit right. I need to replace the rubber.
You're fine. No, you're fine. I had a couple of people comment that increased my microphone volume, so I hit a little boost button, but we'll see if it works. There's not a control on the damn thingamajob here. It's the only one that I've found.
I'm tuning in. I'm on your channel, so I can look at the comments with you. This will be fun.
Okay, thanks. All right, thanks, Salt. I'll try to move my mic a little closer to my yap here. So one of the things that I found was really interesting, we talked about the river coming out to the south. Do you know how old the science says that river is supposed to be, the riverbed that we have there now?
Are you talking about the Tamanrisset River that I mentioned a couple moments ago?
Yes, the one that comes out of the south. It's as Plato describes, right?
Yeah, so he described it to the north. The part to the south is the opening. So the Atlantis was said to have an opening to the sea at the south. And the Rishat structure, clearly within the circular nature of it, has this weird opening at the south, which, by the way, is also covered in surface level salt. And speaking of salt, I should mention that the Western Sahara has an abundance of it. There are salt mines everywhere, and there's camel trains of salt that export salt from Mauritania, not far from the Rishat even today. But when it comes to the river to the north, it was called the Tamanrisset River, Tamanrisset, I believe. And it flowed from the Atlas Mountains. This is according to studies. The study that I had saw mentioned the dates between 11,700 years years ago, up until approximately 5,000 years ago, was when this river had flowed. I don't know if it existed before the 11,000 or didn't work 11,000, but or existed before that. But what I am saying is that it absolutely existed at the time of Atlantis, and you could argue that that would have been the source for water within it. I mean, if you look at maps of where this river had flowed, it goes through the Rishon. And so I try to give some leeway to say, oh, well, maybe perhaps it was just north of it. But there's, if you look at satellite imagery, and David Stig Hansen, who's visited the Rishon structures three times, has been going in depth, but looking at the canals of the site, as well as there's ancient stone quarries around the Rishon structure, which blew my mind. But you could argue that they channeled water into it, if it was indeed further to the north. So it gets pretty wild, and I encourage people to look at the satellite imagery around the site. It's clear that the hand of man had played around with this site at a level that exceeds just primitive Neolithic people, as it's been suggested, that were just doing, you know, hunting with arrows out there. I will also say, to be a devil's advocate on the theory, is that many people will say that, well, there these arrowheads and axe relics and stuff are probably 100,000 years old. And I'm like, well, that's interesting. So to say that, okay, it's not Atlantis, the site's older, there's nothing, you know, from far more recently. And I'm like, okay, well, how did they date these arrowheads? Well, they didn't. They actually compared them to other, you know, known relics, and they're of similar resemblance to make them say, oh, well, these are like relics that we've already found from 100,000 years ago, so those are the dates. And I'm like, that doesn't prove that. It's not. I'm not dismissing that evidence entirely, but I do want to make the point that says that it's not like they have some sort of radiocarbon dating on these arrowheads. It's very possible that people were creating them far more recently, and that they're far younger than even the age of Atlantis. We have to keep in mind the fact that since the data shows that the Sahara Desert has shifted from green to desert approximately every 20,000 years, they don't entirely know why, but the leading theory is that it's involving the Earth's precessional cycle and, you know, natural climate change. And I'm like, okay, so if that area was green and inhabited 5,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago at the time of Atlantis, you know, and had something had happened, we have to keep in mind that the evidence of whatever civilization would have been there if Atlantis was there would have been erased. One, from whatever the catastrophic flooding is, which to me is very clear. I'm not saying it's accepted mainstream science. I am suggesting that they haven't gone looking for it. And let me give you a case in point. The Trans-Saharan Seaway, and I encourage people to look this up on Google Images, had the last time the ocean was known scientifically to have flown through portions of the Sahara was estimated between like 55 and 66 million years ago or something like that, 65 million years ago, the time of the dinosaurs. And what's interesting is that you can see in satellite imagery that the areas where this Trans-Saharan Seaway had flowed, what it doesn't show in the depictions of the Trans-Saharan Seaway is flowing west over the Rishon structure. Yet if you look at the striations in the bedrock, it is my opinion and others, even others that don't even agree with the theory, that...
Oh, no. Shit. Oh, no. Fuck. I lost you there, Jim. Damn it. How's that? Am I still alive? Oh, my God. Okay, hello. Jim, I'm sure that you'll come back here shortly, hopefully. I'm sorry about this. I guess, thank you for the super chats. Yes, the Sahara is bigger than the USA even, and it's very difficult to excavate. And I am completely shocked, Sam, that you would imply that Flint would be dishonest. Can't believe that you would say that at all. Well, shit. He'll be back, I'm sure. Yes, that is a Sega Saturn back there for those of you who asked. Yeah, aliens got him. You are still online. I'm sure that he'll be back. Yeah, his signal just cut right out in the middle of it. It was kind of sad, but I was watching some of the, like I said, some of the videos about it. It was pretty impressive that, how many things were uncanny. They just kind of seemed to all line up in these numerous different ways. Free Jimmy. Oh, I've been sick for over a week. It's driving me up the fucking wall, to be honest with you. Well, trying to reconnect now. No problem, bro. Guess I'm narrating my fucking text messages. I'm almost 50. What do you want? And yes, Jimmy mentioned David Stig Hansen. David Stig Hansen's in the chat right now, and he's going to be on here in just a couple of days to talk about this. And I thought it would be cool to have two different opinions on the thing that overlap heavily, but that don't necessarily completely agree on all the different points. And so hopefully you guys can come and check that out here in a couple of days as well. And well, I guess I'll go ahead and say this now. I was waiting for a moment that it was opportune, and well, Jimmy's just coming back, but hey, here we go. I'll tell you guys in a little bit. Spoiler.
Do you got me?
I do. I'm glad that I made it back. Sorry about that, buddy.
That's on my end. Bro, I haven't lost internet. I've lived at this new place for 4 months. I've never dropped off the internet, and I have it plugged in with an Ethernet cable to have it be as fast as possible. So I don't know what just happened, but that was super frustrating. I'm like, what the heck? But I guess that was only about, what, 2 minutes? So are we okay?
Not long at all. I just addressed the super chats really quick and answered a couple of questions. And yes, mentioned that David's going to be on. You mentioned David Stig Hansen. I mentioned he's coming on in a couple of days that way to kind of fill in the gaps and stuff. You guys' beliefs heavily overlap here, but aren't necessarily 100% identical. So I thought it'd be perfect to have you guys as close as I could. So
nice. Let's just be clear. The powers that be in black suits just attempted to destroy my internet to stop this theory from coming to light. It's the only logical explanation here. The rich Atlantis is under attack by the deep state. Let that sink in.
The chat agrees.
Proof.
We're seeing the World Economic Forum shut off Jimmy's internet. Aliens did it. The feds, very sus.
There's helicopters outside my house. What's going on?
Oh, no. I better check. Better turn off all my...
Funny. But it looks like we're all good now. Thank God. That was embarrassing. I'm like, how did I lose internet?
Don't worry about it. It is what it is. You know, if my kid had a nickel, he's got his stuff plugged in and playing video games, and it's all in the Ethernet, and he crashes every now and again, too, and screams probably louder than you did.
Right. So what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on Atlantis? Do you think it existed? Ask me anything you want about it. Like, I don't know your thoughts.
Oh, thanks. I believe that Atlantis definitely is referencing the myth of Atlantis or whatever, the legend of Atlantis is definitely referencing something that did exist. Here we got Dave, real quickly. David Stig Hansen says,
"I know
planting trees in the right chat as we speak."
Okay. We must do it. We must plant the olive trees. Don't ask me why. I'll tell you. It's to increase the value of the rishat.
Protect the artifacts,
you know,
for
future generations. It's going to preserve. You know, look, there's too much erosion out there, and this will keep the soil nice and tight. It's for the best, and you know. It's being funded by billionaires, so it's perfect.
It'll give the locals a nice touchstone to the community. You know, if they go plant it now in 5 years, it'll be like, look how long we've been harvesting olives from these trees. That was my favorite argument, was that it's like some touchstone. It's just like 30-year-old garden, man. Come on.
We should talk about that. There's a comment I'm noticing from Solus Veer. It says, we need to save the rishat structure for future generations. that's a backhanded comment towards Göbekli Tepe, which, of course, that's been a wild, wild talk. So I'm open to chatting about anything you want. We could bag on the Göbekli Tepe situation.
Absolutely.
Let me know where you want to go.
No, absolutely. I think you've laid out a pretty good case, actually, for the reshot. I hadn't, again, this was all new to me. I'd heard of it, but I hadn't done much research. So the different converging alignment points, I mean, we can definitely move on. Let's check what the Super Chat says here. If you think the word Atlantis out of the discussion, would it still be a site of interest for early civilization?
Now, that sure would.
That is the fucking golden ticket right there. That's what the ultimate barometer, and one that I think is getting lost way too often on the side of big archaeology. They are quite, yeah. Especially with you, man. I swear to God, I've joked about this 100 times, but seriously, you could just like go around and just start saying, you know, I think they should dig more over here. And they'd be like, fucking concrete trees now. The whole damn world.
Anything I talk about, like, I'm like, I would have thought for sure that whether it's the encouraging further excavations of Göbekli Tepe or Gunung Padang, or even addressing more recently the lack of excavation into the mysterious unknown hidden chamber void within the Great Pyramid that was first identified 8 years ago, published in a study 7 years ago, and they, according to the authorities, the Ministry of Antiquities, they have not gone looking and there's no active plan in place to do so. And I'm like, what's going on in the field of archaeology? We have some of the most ancient and most mysterious sites on Earth that are worthy and require further excavation, and it's at a more or less standstill. And let me just clarify, I'm not saying Göbekli Tepe has shut down full excavations. That's not true. They are still excavating to this day. However, it is in writing that they are no longer doing the large-scale excavations that they were doing in the past, and they're deferring it to future generations so they can focus on conservation, which is pretty hilarious considering there's tree roots doing whatever it may be doing to the ruins underneath. And they also have issues with their platforms, the roofing systems that they built over the structure, that it's not stopping snow from blowing in and all kinds of other issues. But regardless, you know, the fact that they said it could be 150 years before the site is fully excavated makes no logical sense on Earth. I've heard people try to use the excuse that they're waiting for future technologies to develop, it, you know, in order to justify the pulling back on excavations. I'm like, what alleged technology are you suggesting would make it safer to dig up the site? Because you've safely unearthed 72 pillars already, and I feel like it's very insulting to anyone's intelligence to suggest that we don't have the technological capability today to safely excavate those ruins there. We already have the ground radar. Although ground radar doesn't necessarily show you the exact shape of certain relics there, since we've already conducted vast LIDAR scan or ground penetrating radar scans there, and we already know what we're looking for and we already know what we've unearthed, they absolutely can tell what is a pillar and what isn't. And I'm sorry, it's like we have water hoses, we have paint brushes to dust it away. We have shovels, and I've had people say they don't use shovels in technology or in archaeology. I'm like, yes, they do. Pickaxes and picks, and there's ways to safely do it. And let me just say two things, which is that, again, I haven't heard anything about any damaged pillars that were unsafely excavated. Like, look, if they were having issues where, like, damn it, we broke another pillar, we need to reevaluate this, I would understand. But, you know, the fact that that's not in, you know, that's not the case. The fact that they're still conducting excavations to this day, although they're not, you know, doing so in a way that's going to unearth all the pillars, they're contradicting themselves. Because if they're saying that they're waiting for future technologies to safely do it, then they're essentially saying that what they're doing now is unsafe. So I'm like, which is it? It's contradicting, and it's, bro, it's gaslighting. I know when I'm being gaslit, and these excuses don't make sense. There is no logical explanation to justify deferring a full excavation for future generations. That doesn't compute with me.
No, I would agree. Really quick, just what a illegitimate scholar said, stratigraphy.
What up, Sam?
Exactly. Hey, buddy. They don't dig lower than they need to. And then he elaborated on that with basically how they found a bunch of Clovis I sites after they knew to look for sites that were pre-Clovis I, after they knew to look for that. And they don't dig deeper than they need to. And that does make sense. But I wanted to touch on the trees a little bit, because this is one thing that they frequently say, the trees, well, it's not that big of a deal. They don't go down very deep. A lot of these things, and I looked into this quite a bit, in there were a few things that it's like, for one, the trees aren't native to that exact spot. So right off the bat, they're they're bringing in different microbes, different, basically, they're bringing in a whole different ecosystem, right? And while the roots may not be really deep growing in and of themselves, which olive trees are known to be damaging to foundations, they're heavily damaging to foundations, But things that are, if there's a site that has water, for example, the tree roots will shoot right down. If there's a well, they're going to shoot right down that well. And there's a site, for example, in Britain where the tree roots, or maybe it's a Roman site, excuse me, where the tree roots have gone down into this well, and it's allowed, it's basically allowed the things that they use to date different levels. One of the things they use is a species of snail that didn't come until a certain day. And this species of snail ends up at far deeper levels than it should because of these tree roots. And so they can't use that to date the region, that little area there. So it even fucks up archaeology on like a real fundamental level. There's no reason for them to advocate for keeping those trees there. But you mentioned them. So they love those fucking olive trees, man.
So, you know what's interesting about this? I saw an interview that Dr. Lee Clare, who is the head of fieldwork of Göbekli Tepe, justify the trees in saying that, yeah, it's going to keep the... It will slow the erosion and keep the site safe, and that these roots are going to grow horizontal based on the species of olive tree, and it shouldn't be an issue. But then he said something else that contradicted himself. He said that they are now... Because the site has come out of under a lot of scrutiny in the media since my videos came out on it and got a lot of people talking about the issue. And he went on to say during this podcast, which was with Flint Devil, by the way, and he said that they're now closely monitoring the tree roots to ensure that it's not destroying the ruins that lay beneath. And I'm like, well, wait a second. Are you saying you're not that confident now that these tree roots could damage the site? Now you're closely monitoring them to ensure that they won't? I'm like, huh, you don't sound too certain now that there isn't an issue here. And I find it very interesting to mention that there is a law within Turkey called the olive tree law, where it is illegal to cut down olive trees in the country of Turkey. It was created, I believe, in 1935. And so they're going to get, unless they get an exception from the government, they're going to get fined over $500 per tree. I don't know how many trees are out there. There's four tree orchards. I think there's probably at least 1,000 trees, give or take. I don't know. At least 500. It's hard to say. I should get somebody to try to count them. But that's an issue because it's like of all things they could have planted. I mean, I guess olive trees are worth something. So if the story is correct that the landowners had planted the olive trees in order to increase the value of the land because the government wasn't going to give them an appropriate price, I can wrap my head around that, and maybe that's just that simple. However, if that's the case, it does highlight a complete mismanagement of the excavation itself, because the site began its excavations around 1994, 1995. The olive trees started being planted in 2005, a full decade after excavations had already begun. And they had already conducted ground radar and knew that there was ruins beneath them. So who is it that allowed these trees to be planted? That in itself is, if nothing else, highlights massive incompetence involving the site. The fact that the olive trees are still there highlights it. You know, if there's no conspiracy here to prevent excavations, if nothing else, it's mismanagement and incompetence. That's the best case scenario. The other best case scenario is that the Doges Group, which is a billion-dollar conglomerate of comprising of 250 companies that's located in Turkey, and they're now the ones funding the site. So there's no shortage of funding there. No one has suggested there was. The devil's advocates say it, but I'm like, the authorities themselves have never suggested it. But so it's not about money. But if nothing else, let's just say these people are not trying to prohibit excavations, you know, for anything sinister. If nothing else, they already invested millions of dollars into the tourism infrastructure of the site. It went from having 19,000 visitors a year a handful of years ago to now at just under 500,000 a year. And so you could call it a tourism cash cow. That if nothing else, there's just rich people running the show there. And they're like, hey, no. We've invested enough money. I want a return on the dollar. Let's just keep the funding going and let's, you know, pull back on these expensive excavations. That's the other best case scenario. I don't know.
When you say the best case scenario, like if I take the least suppositions in both cases, both with Göbekli Tepe and with the Great Pyramid's missing or hidden chamber, especially in Egypt, they've already known this for a while. Zahi Hawass has got that quote where he says, it doesn't matter what is happening in Egypt, the New Age people, they come. He knows that the people that are interested in the Great Pyramid as far as like a mysterious angle, they don't give a shit about the Arab Spring didn't stop them like it did your casual traveler.
Right.
But so what I'm getting at here is that leaving as much mystery intact as possible, cultivating as much conspiracy as possible, getting as many different people to think as many different, so they have to come and visit that thing themselves to get there, to get the real view of it. This is not, so as you say, like best case scenario, it's being mismanaged. It's almost like it's a poorer nation using a tourism thing to just start beating money out of as many people as they can. Let me address a couple of super chats really quick before we carry on. Okay, we got Preston here says tons of unique laser cut polygon stones fitting together like purpose Jenga puzzle. Similarly in Peru, Japan, and elsewhere with only chisels, ropes, pulleys, and hard labor. So I don't think any of us would. I'm personally not into the board with lasers, but I don't think it was just done so simply as many say. What do you think about that, Jim?
Forgive me, I was reading a different comment I was checking my mic settings. Forgive me, what was the comment?
Oh, it was about
I was trying to multitask while you were doing that.
Yeah, you're all good, brother. It's about the like a laser cut stones. You said the polygonal stones that are a question.
Oh, I see it.
Okay, there you go.
So I have multiple thoughts on this. When I was in Japan, let me first mention Japan and then go on to Peru. I saw some exquisite stonework there. I did see on some of the largest stones evidence that they did use wood wedges to separate the stones. So I did see that. But I did also see evidence that they had sawed them and that they looked like they raked them. But when it comes to Peru, whether it's Sacsayhuaman or various relics in Cusco, before I had went to Peru in 2021, I went there with the assumption, I'm like, I feel like this was done with laser-like precision. I'm not saying done by lasers. I'm just saying like cut with laser-like precision. But when I was there, it almost seems like, and I'm not saying geopolymer, but mm-hmm. it almost seems they were slightly molded. And what's interesting is that the legend out of Peru is that there was a species of bird that once existed there, which the saliva was, when the birds were creating their nests in the rocks, the Inca observed that the saliva was essentially eating away at the stone or softening it in some way. That's just the legend. And mm-hmm. then I look at these stones, when I was able to put my hand between them as they moved over time, brother, it was so smooth. There was nothing about it that was cut. I was expecting to feel like saw marks or just some raking or some scrapes or something. Bro, it was like smooth, like almost polished. And so then I thought of that legend. I'm like, that's interesting. I'm not saying it's true, but it's just something. The stonework there is so spectacular. The way you have this one stone that has like 12 cuts to it, or maybe it's 14. I want to say 12 though. And there's many of them like it. And it's like with the level of precision and the way they fit together, like it's a puzzle. It just doesn't seem feasible to suggest that it was done with bronze chisels and stone hammers and whatnot. And it seems to me that it's evidence of lost technology. I'm not saying it's lasers. I'm simply saying that there was a method utilized to create those stones that we're not familiar with or is unknown in the academic and archaeological record.
Yeah, I would say that there's no question that there's some things that were definitely unknown. I mean, the one that's the smoking gun to me is, as having worked construction a long time, the way that the Great Pyramid itself is aligned to itself is that shit's hard to do on a much smaller scale if you put something in the middle, because generally speaking, oh shit, there went Jim again. Oh no, man, the fucking New World Order is not letting us have this here chat. Now I went and said New World Order, so now they're coming to get us. Oh, he's back. Okay, there you go.
That was my fault. That wasn't the internet. I had a button, so we're good. I could hear you. I could hear you the whole time.
All right. What were we talking about? But the stones, the way the different stones were shaped, the Great Pyramid. The way that the pyramids all had this big, massive chunk of bedrock in the center, so you couldn't measure across the middle. And the way that you square a perimeter, generally speaking, is to measure your four four ways and then across the center, and all those measurements should be the same. You can't measure across the center in that case. And at 756 feet, the rope sag is going to be significant enough that you're going to have a pretty significant margin of error. And we've got like 2 inches, like 3 inches is the worst, I believe. So it's really, I recognize it as something I wouldn't be able to do on a job site with, unless I had a transit. It's like, that's the kind of tool I would need in order to do something like this. So right off the bat, the articles you read about it, I mean, one of the fucking science papers, they actually talk about how they must have measured across the center. And it's like, yeah, boneheads, they couldn't measure across the center, but they, you know, it just gets cited because they, no experience. As I joke online or on Twitter sometimes, these guys, most of them have never built a fire pit in their backyard, let alone, you know, something real. So that, how the fuck are they going to weigh in on this?
Right. Right. And that's a really good point. You know, a lot of the things that these archaeologists talk about, I feel like they're chasing after views and clicks because they're kind of going outside their own comfort zones, or not comfort zones, their levels of expertise, which is, I'm not opposed to it, but they're kind of contradicting themselves that they come after me for the same thing. They'll say, well, Jimmy does not have a degree in archaeology or anthropology. He's not qualified to discuss on this matter. And then they go and talk about things that they have no professional or educational experience in. And they do it often now, especially we've seen this with the emergence of Graham Hancock's theories and ancient apocalypse. People went out of the woodwork to create videos debunking it when they themselves are people that study ancient bones and they don't have any experience professionally or educationally in the mysteries of ancient civilizations or ancient, you know, anything, you know, related to archaeology, some of them. And so that's worth mentioning. Like, you know, there's a lot of people in this realm that just kind of want to be right.
Oh, yeah. And like one thing I noticed right when I first started making videos was Graham Hancock in particular, but alternate history Atlantis in general. But Graham Hancock in particular, he's a stepping stone for archaeologists that are want to be content creators. If you go find you can go find plenty of archaeologists that have like 50 to 100 or 500 subscribers, and they'll have one video that's got like 5,000 views and a lot of attaboys, and it'll be like part one of my debunking of ancient apocalypse. It'll be like meandering, you know, early YouTuber video that's not very good at it, but they're learning, and their first stepping stone, their first big getting views was picking on Hancock. People will come tolerate their horrible video editing skills to watch them talk shit about Graham. So,
right,
it's almost like a rite of passage for these people, and they generally speaking have very little idea as to his real like ideas, which is one of the funniest things about it. It's like you'll see them constantly, oh, I want to debunk Graham, and it's like the lava tubes in Gunung Padang. If those are just lava tubes in there, that doesn't change the fact that those could be chambers that people utilize. And it's exactly right. The kind of thing that would fit with Graham's theories. But it's like, oh, no, if they're not completely hewn chambers by human hands, this doesn't fucking count. Have you read any of his books? Yeah, I read The Mars Mystery. you didn't read any. I read the one that I picked on. It's over on my shelf right now. It's so typical.
Right. Real quick, I want to mention, there was a comment, a super chat you had on a moment ago from Solas Vera that says, I doubt the wrist shot is archaeologically significant, but here's $10 because I like you guys. I'm looking forward to the discussion. Let me rebut him and say that I believe that it is archaeologically significant. Like, remove Atlantis. Let's just say Atlantis never existed, or if it did, it's not the Rishat structure. There are indeed ancient relics found in and around the site of the Rishat, which we have no idea who they're from. Now, you could just dismiss it as being hunters and gatherers, you know, from 10,000, you know, 100,000 years ago. But it's like, hold on a second. Atlantis aside, it is an archaeological site. It is a fact that they found all kinds of stuff around there. And the people who come out wanting to debunk the theory of Atlantis in the Rishat kind of just gloss over the fact that, like, hey, hang on a second. If nothing else, there is something to be learned here about ancient history. You know, it doesn't have to be Atlantis and a spectacular or some advanced lost ancient civilization, but don't just gloss over the site in itself. Additionally, from a geological standpoint, you know, it is such a unique feature. Oh, and that reminds me of another bullet point to suggest that it was the site of Atlantis. The naysayers will say the Rishat is a natural anomaly, so therefore it could not be Atlantis because Atlantis was made by Poseidon. Well, if you look into the ancient Greek meaning for the word Poseidon, it was not describing an individual. It was describing the gods of, you know, the oceans and earthquakes. And I'm like, okay, maybe they're describing that it was man-made, that it is a literally, that it was Mother Nature, that the term Poseidon was another term for Mother Nature. And when I look at the fluvial erosion over the site, or whether it's just the bizarre nature of it, even if it's just a collapsed volcanic dome, which I have thoughts on that because the nature of the concentric circles is like nothing found anywhere else. I have seen examples of collapsed volcanic domes, and there's barely a comparison. It's not totally circular in nature time and time again. It's usually like a blob that's collapsed and an area around it that's looking like it collapsed around it. And that's the only similarity, but it's not uniquely concentric. So the Rishat structure, even if it is just a natural anomaly, which I think that it is, or perhaps humans had tampered with it and geoengineered it, whatever the case may be, it's worthy of scientific study. So a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to debunk me, and they're not focusing in on the key aspects that do need to be studied. It is a geological mystery. Like, if you read the actual science on it, although they have leading theories that it's collapsed dome, if you read the actual fine literature on it, they say they don't know. They say this. They say it is literally worded as a mystery. I've read that somewhere. And so, you know, it's like details like this. I'm like, okay, guys, you don't have to believe in Atlantis, or you don't have to believe it's at the Rishat, but why don't you focus on the site itself, because there's something to be learned here.
Well, even if it is, like a local enterprise broadcasting points, he's sorry to play the other side here, but it looks like a collapsed volcano caldera. Mm-hmm. And just to say, to play devil's advocate, even if it is, just like those lava tubes in Gunung Padang, it doesn't matter. David Stig Hansen mentioned in the mm-hmm. chat that Plato said that they used a natural site, and it doesn't matter what right. How those concentric circles got there. It's that they were there,
right.
So I think a lot of those things, I think a lot of the, when people get into the debunking mindset, I complain about that a lot. When people get into this debunker mindset, they lose this, there's a degree of honesty almost that kind of gets lost, where they're looking just to prove the other person wrong, prove themselves mm-hmm. right. And at that point, they're like, you know, the facts, not so important. Yeah.
Real quick, this super chat you had from Local Enterprise Broadcasting, yes. where he said, sorry to play the other side here, but it looks like a collapsed volcano caldera. There are several of similar formations in southern Utah and the Mojave Desert. I disagree. I'm not saying that it's not volcanic in nature, but I've seen these examples of volcanic calderas, and they are not comprising of concentric circles. They're just not. It's a blob of a misshaped blob. And it's not to say that there isn't a collapsed nature with the area surrounding it that's, you know, enveloping and surrounding it, you know, above it, the collapse part. But that's the extent of the similarity. The Rishat structure is indeed one of a kind. There is, you know, it is a special site. So I'm not so sure that that's the full explanation. But who knows, you know? It's a fun topic.
Well, yeah, and that's what you were talking about earlier before the Super Chat, the way that it's, there's a lot to be learned there, but it doesn't have to have anything to do with Atlantis or whatnot. This is one of the things that I think archaeologists that are trying to engage in PR and in public outreach really miss the boat on this one, because here is sites like this, like Gunung Padang, like the Great Pyramid, which they've used this, but sites like Göbekli Tepe, there's so much public interest from people that are not thinking in line with mainstream archaeology or whatever, but they are willing to travel there. They're willing to throw money at tours, and they would be mm-hmm. willing to finance somebody that they had belief would be honest about going and doing this stuff. But they could really use this in order to fund more digging. you know, in order to, to get those trees out of the way and to see what the hell's actually going on. But instead, we get these fights over every little aspect of it. It seems like we have to battle over to the point where it's almost not. I almost get worn out with it. It's like, good God.
Yeah, I saw a comment a little bit earlier where someone saying that if they were to increase the excavations at Göbekli Tepe, perhaps that would increase tourism. I'm like, that's actually an interesting point. If you could have some sort of VIP pass that you pay for, let's just say certain groups pay a premium and they get led down, they're able to get a view, that they're not interfering, but just like, you know, to be part of it, like, wow, look at them actively digging. Like what they're doing out there, which people can witness today, brother, they're not doing much. There's somebody that visits the site often that's routinely sending me videos on Instagram, and I've shared a few of them, and they're not unearthing much. They're not. I'm not saying they're not digging up any pillars and that they haven't dug up any pillars in the last year, but they're like the areas of the site, they're not making any type of large scale attempt. It is abundantly clear, and they've said it themselves, that they're not going to do so in our lifetimes. You know, people need to focus on that and start asking questions, because, you know, it's not about funding. And even if it was, they could raise the funding through the tourism. This is doable. It's inexcusable not to dig up what is one of arguably the world's oldest and most mysterious ancient sites is Göbekli Tepe. It wasn't supposed to exist. And the naysayers like Flint Dibbles, they'll say, you know, they basically discard it as something less than what it was. Like, this is not evidence of a lost civilization. I'm like, you really are suggesting this was built by just hunters and gatherers? No, I would say that it was some sort of sophisticated civilization that took it upon themselves to construct it. And we don't know who it was or why they did it. It is a fact. We don't know what it is. There are theories. The most recent study on it from a few months ago suggested that it's potentially the world's oldest lunisolar calendar. And if that's the case, then that is absolutely not supposed to exist 11,600 years ago based on what we were taught in school.
Yeah.
You know, and let me just say one last thing. Considering we don't know for sure what it is, that's all the more reason to go excavate it, because perhaps there's answers waiting to be unearthed. Because on all these pillars, and there's been 72 that have been unearthed, they believe through ground radar there's approximately 200. So if those numbers are accurate, that means there's somewhere around 128 under the earth. And considering that all these pillars have depictions on them and are trying to tell us something, it's a story of some kind, or at least it's a monument of some kind that means something or meant something to whoever created it, it is extremely reasonable to say, in fact, it'd be illogical and unreasonable to say that there isn't additional information waiting to be found. Maybe we'll never know what the site is, even if we dig everything up. But there is things that have not been seen that are waiting to be found that could shed light and give us answers, or at least teach us more than what we know today. So again, it is inexcusable for this site to not be excavated in our lifetimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we address a super chat really quick, the idea that there is no language, no message to be portrayed there. You know, if there is a language or a message you portray there, we would need to have as much of that information as possible in order to crack the code. And
yeah,
we would need to have as much of that iconography as available for us to look at. I'm actually interviewing Dr. Martin Sweatman here soon to talk about that calendar paper.
Nice. That's
pretty interesting stuff. But yeah, well, what do you want to, you can see the super chat there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Do you want to...
I just answered him and said, great comment. He said, perhaps I should add some context. The site I'm referencing are located on bombing and artillery ranges. I have seen them with my own two eyes, but good luck finding it on Google Earth. Right on.
All right. Yep, that is true. There are places that are just little blobs on Google Earth. I actually get people sending me Google Earth images fairly frequently. I imagine that probably happens to you a lot more than me,
yeah.
I'm guessing. But yeah,
I get some.
Quite a few. So that's pretty interesting too. You look at it and it's like, God, I just wish that it was local, because I'd go check it out, but I'm not gonna, you know.
Right.
Google Earth, you have the same thing. Cool. Yeah, look at that.
Yeah.
Not much I can do with it. But I always appreciate people sending stuff. Like a lot of times people think they're telling you something you already know, so they don't send it, and that's the stuff. Murphy's Law says that's the thing that I need you to send, Matt. So
right.
So, said it all the time doing like buying and selling things on eBay, where I'd have people email me or text me and be like, hey man, my friend, or I saw at the pawn shop, a blah, 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 but I thought you might not want it. Always 99 times out of 100, I'll tell you no thank you, but that one time that I say thank you, it'll make me a fortune, so thank you.
Right. I like that thought process. It's true.
It is. Yeah, it's nice to have followers that throw a lot of information, and even the ones like Dr. Steve J here, he's here to hate watch me and to be a nice little troll. He's always
is
nice
he in the comments?
See. Oh yeah, he's in the comments. But
what was his name?
Dr. Steve J. He's one of the guys telling us that we don't know anything.
Okay, well, he should totally start a YouTube channel and inform us and teach us everything we need to know, because I don't know if these little comments are going to do it. Yeah. I mean, hey, Steve J., I'll look at your comment. Share something substantial, or you know, and let's discuss it. You know, I'm open-minded. He said yes, because it's a historical site. They are not trying to destroy the site. What? Yeah, we're not talking about destroying it. We're talking about excavating it safely,
I think what he's saying there is that archaeologists are incapable of excavating a site without destroying it. I could be hearing him wrong, but that's we're going to play the troll game. That's what I hear.
He said yes, because YouTube is where peer-reviewed research is posted. Well, actually, in this conversation itself, I have mentioned multiple scientific studies talking about the Tamanrasset River flowing from the Atlas Mountains, talking about a vast network of rivers existing in the Sahara, the largest freshwater lake in Earth's known history to exist there, the evidence of human migration, the evidence that they have said that in these studies, peer-reviewed studies, that the Sahara was once lush green in a tropical paradise that would have been consisting of vast civilizations. All of that is peer-reviewed stuff, and I have shown the screenshots of these studies in these videos I've discussed. So I recommend that you go rewatch my videos. Take some notes, and I promise you might learn something.
he's saying it's not posting it on it's, of course, he's just being he's a pedantic troll.
It's all good. I enjoy it. It's fun. It's all fun.
That's what got me started making videos, was people that I thought were doing it wrong. We got this super chat here: Younger Dryas impact theory and Plato's Atlantis story sharing dates. That is accurate. They are. The Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and the Younger Dryas in general, and you could just remove the impact hypothesis and all of the controversy surrounding that. The Younger Dryas and Plato's Atlantis story share dates. That's a fact.
Mm.
And the Younger Dryas is a time of extreme climatic change and sea levels rising and all that jazz. That's also a fact. So.
It is such a consequential detail that further adds the validity that Atlantis had existed. Because the fact that Plato had said that when Solon had visited there was in, 600 BC? And so that's 2,600 years ago. And at that time, he was, as the legend goes, the Egyptian priest at the temple of Neith in Sais, Egypt, or the temple of Sais in Neith, Egypt. I know the answer. I've talked about this a million times. Regardless, said that it was 9,000 years before their time, which would equate to 11,600 years ago, which, like you just said, coincides with the Younger Dryas climate catastrophe. Whatever caused it, whether it was a cosmic impact or something else, that's not the topic of the discussion that I'm focusing on in this moment. It's the fact that the Earth went through an upheaval, and it was a cataclysm, and it is a scientific fact corroborated by peer-reviewed studies that show that it happened. So what a unique coincidence that it just so happens to mirror Plato's description when a civilization was obliterated. I think that it is strong corresponding evidence that adds to the validity that Atlantis was, whatever Atlantis was, that there was a civilization that was obliterated by a cataclysm at that time.
Yeah, that's the kind of thinking that, I mean, it's not very difficult to imagine there being a kernel of truth to this story, right? So you're talking, if you go to Plato's time, you're talking, 7,000 years have passed or 9,000 years have passed. That's a long ass time. The legend will have morphed, right? But like with the cargo cults, we saw that the legend, it don't take 20 years before a legend goes from like real people bringing them advanced technology to this guy's a messiah. It takes like that long. But 9,000 years, the core things that could remain, much like your post about the Nephilim on Twitter a while back, The core That's things that could remain, just tiny little pieces that could remain, like this civilization was lost to the flood, and then some little things line up. And honestly, when they talk about their evidence for it being an allegory, a lot of that could just be stuff that Plato stapled on. In my opinion, most likely is things that Plato stapled on to something they already believed existed. Like if somebody mm-hmm. was to try to make an argument that the society is collapsing today and they start citing the Roman Empire, they don't tell you about how freaking Harry Potter's world fell apart. They start talking right. about real world shit. That's duh.
Yep.
But that seems like kind of common sense stuff to me. Some people think that like that's their go-to to debunk it is just to say that it was an allegory and that's that. A lot like the vases when they just go to short-circuit it with the all of them have shit provenance, so therefore nothing to see here. Ignore it all.
What's in you know what they ignore is that fact that Plato wasn't a fiction writer. They make it sound like, for example, the allegory of a cave was described. That's the title, allegory. it wasn't the allegory of Atlantis, and as the legend goes, it was Solon, who was said to be wisest of the seven sages, who was a statesman and someone of particular upstanding within ancient Greek culture. Here's something I thought of. So someone like Flint Dibble has said that people like myself and Graham Hancock and others are ripping the history from the natives, and when we were diminishing their stories by suggesting it was something alternative. And I'm like, is that not what you're doing right now to those people who lived at that time that shared this story? This is what they said. And I'm more inclined to listen to the works of Plato and Solon over some academic that memorized a bunch of stuff and is regurgitating it with their little PhD. I'm like, you guys are now diminishing those brown people called the Egyptians that wrote this in their stonework and passed it down to other people. So it's extremely hypocritical. And if they want to go there, it's like, they have no self-awareness, because I'm like, how do they not see that that's exactly what they're doing? By denying the tale of Atlantis, you are stripping the Egyptians of their culture, and they're brown, so you should be, are you racist? Because, I don't know.
Oh my God, yes, that whole slippery slope. I'm working on a video now going through a paper that, holy shit, one of my subscribers, Rubate, sent the paper, and I glanced at it before, but he's like, man, you need to go through this, and I was like going through with the fight you told, just, geez, Christ, man, it is unbelievable. Right. It is unbelievable. But one of my favorite pieces of evidence is they're like, well, Graham Hancock's work is a threat to our democracy. And it's like, what? And the reasoning is, well, the QAnon shaman liked Graham Hancock, and since he was part of the whole, I was just like, oh my fucking God, dude, this is, did he like bicycles? How about Justin Bieber? Was the man a Justin Bieber fan? I mean, come the fuck on. What does this have to do with him doing the White House thing? But anyway, we should probably address the super chat before it disappears here. What do we got?
Yeah, it's a little off topic, but I appreciate that they're asking. Question from Right Insight: is it possible that the fitment of the stones of Peru was done using resonance, vibration, cutting agents? Hey, anything's possible. The answer is I don't know, and I'll be honest to say I don't know. I don't know how they did it, but they did something, and it wasn't with the use of bronze saws or chisels. That is what I'm firm on. So yes, it's a technology of some kind. And when you look at the resonance, everything is sound. And so, yeah, I'm open-minded, but I can't answer the question either way. I don't know how they did it. And that's one of the funnest things about the topic, is that we just don't know. And that's why we need to do further excavations and field work and continue to investigate. The answers could be out there somewhere. But the mystery is real.
Yeah, it will take honest inquiry. It's one of the things I kind of harp about a lot. I'm sure you've seen that. We can't, if they leave it to just the people that are less, that are more interested in looking for Atlantis or something like that, then naturally they're less skeptical. So we end up with a lot of evidence that's interesting and intriguing, but they dismiss it out of hand. The vases are always my go-to example of this, but all of these things, like how do they shape these stones? Well, there's a lot of different ideas. When you look at the polygonal masonry, they can't just simply saying that they did it by hand chisels and everything is I'm not saying they used higher technology, but I've said it a bunch of times that stone was the premier building material for literally millions of years for hominids. They were using it long before human beings existed. Other creatures, our ancestors, were using stone. So the knowledge base of one generation teaching the next on how to do this stuff was so fucking high before the age of metal began. Then when we started using metal, quickly, a lot of these knowledges would get lost. And a lot of this stuff could be extremely low tech, but so profound that you just look at it, you're like, well, fuck me. How did I not think of that? Well, you didn't have a million years of experience sitting behind you.
Right, right. I'm making a comment to Dr. Steve J. I said, Dr., in quotes, Steve J. hasn't taught me anything so far. And I'm referring to his comments here. I noticed that people are going back and forth in the comments. So it's fun having lively chats going on. And it's kind of fun to be able to do it here because usually when I'm running a live stream on my end, I'm focused on other things. But as a guest on here, I don't have to worry about that stuff. So it's kind of fun to be able to like come in and like respond like while I'm doing this. It's kind of fun.
No, that's great. That is great. I definitely have a hard time keeping up with the chat when I'm glad I do the super chats in a big fat bold thing because otherwise I would miss those too. Speaking of, right. Caleb says that he was in an anthropology program and taking archaeology classes, and I think archaeology is rigorous and can be very robust, but can also not be. Now, that I would agree with, that there's parts of it that are very science heavy, and then there are parts of it that are very interpretation heavy. And when they try to conflate those two, that's really where you end up with a lot of problems, in my opinion. Just trying to tell me that you're, like when you're talking about the dating of artifacts, in the Rishat area, and they're like, well, we date these according to the context of these other of the same style, but it's like that doesn't necessarily prove that these are from then. So
yeah, let me just say, I've seen so many photos of various artifacts that have been found around the Rishat, including arrowheads and stone axes and stuff like that, and brother, it looks like something I would make. Like, I'm like, I don't make, it's not something so unique that says, hold on a second, we know which culture this came from. Brother, they look like freaking arrowheads and freaking stone axes that anyone that wanted to make one out of stone would do. I think that they are, look, I wasn't with the people that did the study. I haven't talked to them personally to say, tell me exactly how you know this. But from my own looking at it, I'm like, you shouldn't conclude anything. And if someone had made something similar 100,000 years ago, well, it's completely feasible that somebody on their own ingenuity had done the same thing at the time of Atlantis, or more reasonably, I think those artifacts are probably somewhere around 5,000 to 10,000 years old after the Atlantis theory, because I think that if the theory is correct on the Rishat Atlantis theory, I believe that it was bulldozed somewhere around the 11,000 year, 12,000 year time frame. That may not be true. This is not proven. I'm just simply in the context of the theory itself that we're talking that there was many thousands of years of this site existing. Let's just say the Rishat structure was Atlantis. Atlantis was real. It's the site. And it was destroyed through a cataclysmic wave of some kind 11,700 years ago. Let's just pretend that was a fact. Well, things happened after that. You know, that was 11,600 years ago. The Sahara was still green for another, you know, 6,000 years after that fact. So, like, that's a long time of natural erosion processes as well as human inhabitation in the area, in the region. And they would have been doing stuff and leaving stuff. You know what I mean? So I'm like, it's possible that Atlantis was erased and then other people came in and were there afterwards. That's not unreasonable to suggest. It might not be the case. I can admit that. I don't know. But, like, it doesn't disprove it. Because people say, well, this disproves the theory. And I'm like, no, it doesn't. There's fluvial erosion over that site. People, let me say this, actually.
Yeah.
Because I made a video, like, 2 years ago or whatever it was, year and a half ago, whatever it was, addressing skeptics going after the Rishat. And they'll say that, no, that's not fluvial water erosion, that it's wind erosion. I'm like, okay. So I took it upon myself to research the windiest places on Earth. And in fact, you can find various articles that will tell you the top 10 windiest places on Earth. Number one is Antarctica. I believe the number two is in New Zealand. And then there's a site in a mountain in Maine. And then there's another location outside of Dodge City in Kansas. And anyway, so I go looking through the 10 windiest places on Earth and through looking through Google satellite imagery. And none of them have any type of resemblance of erosion like we see around the Rishat structure. And honestly, Antarctica being the windiest site on Earth and being covered in snow and ice, which would easily be shaped by the wind more so than stone, and it doesn't have those striations. It doesn't. None of the sites resemble any of the features that we see of erosion around the Rishat structure and the Western Sahara. And, you know, when I look at someone like Randall Carlson, who's a very smart individual, and although he does not agree with the Rishat structure being Atlantis, he thinks it's the Azores, and I respect his opinion. But even he himself, who many consider him to be an expert in catastrophism, even he himself presented that the site of the Rishat in the Western Sahara appears to have been subject to one or many fluvial events of catastrophic nature. And the same current ripples that we see in, you know, eastern Washington that you visited recently, by the way, those same features exist around the Rishat, but they're even larger, significantly larger. It looks like the ocean blasted that area. I know mainstream science doesn't agree with me, so to anyone listening, like I'm telling you, okay, this is pseudoscience. Call it whatever you want. I don't care. I'm simply saying that I have eyes to see, and if I had to bet money knowing that the answer could be found, I'm going heavy on that the ocean, that water did something to the Western Sahara far more recently than what has been described through the scientific studies involving the Trans-Saharan Seaway, which, again, don't even show it going over the Western Sahara. If nothing else, they should at least suggest that it did at that time, and they were just incorrect.
We got here Metal Keen 1417. A lot of groups seem to think this is not the first era of man. The Greeks had the gold, silver, and bronze, Hindu, Yugas, Aztec, etc., etc. That is true. That is something that you see in a lot of different creation myths, that there are numerous ages of man.
Right. And I buy into that. I don't think that's unreasonable. I think it's the case, especially when you look at the nature of ice ages and interglacial periods. I think that it's very unusual that humans in our modern cranial capacity are somewhere around 300 or so thousand years old, and we only know stuff about our history going back 6,000 years, barely. And so that's a whole lot of time in between 6,000 years and 300 plus thousand years ago for us to be doing a whole lot of nothing. I'm not so sure that that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Local Enterprise Broadcasting says again, he thinks Amon is right. The key to understanding our past is the best understanding of the Greek language.
Hmm.
That's interesting. What we got here? Enigma Seeker wants to tell me that Atlantis is in Egypt. Well, I host you to explain. Maybe one of these days. I know that you're a big fan of that one, Enigma Seeker, but I'm not a big fan of the idea that Atlantis is Egypt. It doesn't seem like the most compelling hypothesis to me personally, but maybe one of these days we can talk about it. You should never speak like that to Jimmy, Dan, or anyone else. That's why you do it behind a computer screen.
who's illegitimate scholar, who's Sam? Who's he talking to right now? Because I'm only just seeing the... I haven't been looking at the chat.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure who the hell he's talking to. Did I say something mean to you? Oh, come on. I don't have to fucking delete these people. Every now and again, we get somebody that wants to be a spicy boy. It's like, God damn
it. I don't see... Did you see something bad? I can't find it. I don't know.
I removed one.
Okay.
It's about Stevie says. Yeah, there was just one guy that I removed. It's, you know, I hate to say it, guys. I am a big fan of free speech, but I have this channel on YouTube. It's not my channel. So if you wouldn't say this on the PlayStation Network, please don't say it in my fucking comments. I mean, I hate to have to remove your shit, but I don't know what else to do, okay? If you say something too spicy, then I'm going to end up with my shit getting banned because of your being a spicy boy.
I want to know what he said. I'm so sad. I wish I could see it.
No, the comment that I removed was just some typical racist.
Okay.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with the funny stuff. It just popped up in the middle. I was like, ah, fuck. One of these days, I'm going to need to hire a mod, but I have to hide somebody who's like in prison and working for pennies or something.
Yeah.
Get my 16-year-old to do it. You want an extra half hour of game time, right?
Love it.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to consider, the way that sites like Rishot get quickly ignored when they become part of the alternate history canon. The first thing that I noticed with this, as I talked about a couple of times with Matt Bell, was it was long before I really got huge into Atlantis, was that not long before, but the Face on Mars, like that was the way that they just refused to go back and look at it. And everything just kept getting doctored. It's just like always just the goalposts shifted and it just like, we don't really care what the public that finances these expeditions to Mars wants to see. Fuck those guys. It was just like, man, this is weird. This is just fucking weird. It's like this hubris. It's like, fuck these guys, even though these guys, again, like you start talking about the finances, the money behind archaeology here in the States. It's taxpayers have a lot of it. That's not all. There's a lot of private stuff, but a lot of the big digs and stuff, a lot of the main public works and shit, a lot of that stuff is taxpayer funded.
Right.
The universities are definitely getting money from the states.
Right.
One thing I teased, I was going to announce earlier, I should go ahead and say it now, speaking of the taxpayer funding, a guy who recently put that in my head to think about was, I was talking to Christopher Dunn, like I mentioned to you earlier, and just to announce to the channel, here coming up here on the 15th, Christopher Dunn's going to be on the first live stream of what may well be many. We'll be talking about the Petri Core number 7. And here in just a couple of days, I'll have David Stig Hansen on, like I mentioned earlier.
Nice.
Yeah, Christopher Dunn reached out and wanted to discuss. He was happy that I was skeptical of a lot of the stuff and had alternate explanations, but not an asshole and willing to admit when I was wrong. So he wants to have a chat.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Be fun.
I look forward to watching that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it'll be fun talking to him. He's really a smart guy. Although I disagree with some of his conclusions, he's really, really intelligent about how he goes about it. And he's a machinist, and my dad was a machinist for decades, so I can speak the language somewhat.
Nice.
By the way, I'm doing this right. I'm buttering it up because I have a video about you, Dan. Wally Wallington solved more than you give him credit for. Video to be released soon. Uh-oh. Dun-dun-dun.
Didn't Wally Wallington die with his secrets? I don't like that. If he had something to share, he should have shared it with the good people of planet Earth before his departure. So I don't know what the story is on his site, but I haven't done a super deep dive. I just know that there were some controversies there. I mean, if he didn't show his alleged technology of floating the stones, why should I believe that it was true? He died with the secret? I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah, I mentioned that a lot of the stuff that he did wasn't like rolling, like moving the stones through the woods and stuff, you know, moving the stones on a nice set environment that he's went and cultivated and carefully made his path and everything is one thing, but turning around and being like, I'm trying to extrapolate that into like Gnong Padong, whether moving those basalt monoliths up and downhill, you fuck you, that ain't happening. I got nothing to do with Wally Wallington. Caleb, our first David Stig Hansen says, I brought Chris Dunn a beer at CPAC. I have not done that yet, but here hopefully I'll be able to. I'll at least get to chat with him online, and one of these days maybe I'll get to meet him in person. I've got family near where he lives, only about an hour drive from where he lives. So, one of these days.
I met him at the CPAC conference, and he is such a sweetheart. Like, he's such a nice guy. We really hit it off, to be honest. And you're gonna like him. Like, I know you've already chatted with him, but I mean, like, when you further, you know, you already know him by just as much as I do or better, because I only met him a couple times over a course of a weekend conference. But I really like the guy. What a very personable person. Loved them.
Yeah, I'm literally looking forward to having more conversations with you. We talked for a good hour on the phone, getting everything set up. Quick, we have inspired Caleb to get into anthropology, so thanks. I hope it's anthropology and not like anthropophagism, but...
You know, it's interesting, Dan, you're going to see more and more comments like this. So over the course of my channel, this is one of my favorite comments to get. I have had many times people reach out to say, hey, you inspired me to go study archaeology. You inspired me to go, you know, or I'm switching my major. I was into, I've been kind of playing around with school for a year and I don't like it. And I want to go study anthropology now. And I'm like, holy crap, to know that I have had an impact on somebody to change the course of their career. And here you are, you have someone saying it to you now. And so you're going to see more and more of that because, like, you know, with the comment earlier with someone saying that, you know, archaeology is a rigorous academic endeavor. Yeah. And I have no doubt that I could learn so much from these academics. What we do need is more people going into those programs with a skeptical mind. I'm not saying they go in there and disagree with their professor and waste everyone's time because it's going to have no impact probably other than just creating earning themselves a bad grade by some biased liberal professor. But it would be great to see more people in that field of higher caliber. I know there are many brilliant archaeologists and anthropologists out there. However, some of the noisiest ones out there aren't necessarily representing their field very well. And I think that, you know, I think I shared this with you before when we did the live stream, is that there's a lot of people within the science fields that don't look too highly on archaeologists. Archaeologists like to call themselves scientists, but that's very debatable. And I don't care either way. I'm not trashing them and saying they're not scientists. I don't care. Like, I'm not a scientist either. I'm not an archaeologist. Like, I don't care. Either you're an open-minded individual that goes looking for information and communicates it, or you don't. I just think that archaeology could use some positive people in some higher caliber people in the landscape that is getting a lot of the attention these days. I'll just say that.
Yeah, it's a frustrating reality that the people that are that get the most eyeballs are generally the biggest assholes. That's just how that works in any community now, especially with social media. Really quickly, we should address the super chats really fast. Local Enterprise Broadcasting said that you were thinking of the wrong guy. I was thinking of the right guy with Wally Wallington. So, I guess Wally didn't die with his secrets, I don't think. He was about like putting a stone under things and like a fulcrum
point, okay.
Pivot points and stuff.
So I was, correct me then. So to explain, he didn't die with any secrets? Like, I thought he was saying that.
Wally Wallington, he was just. Most of his stuff, like his most advanced thing that I've seen was like a bunch of kind of, he had a way to roll a stone across a bunch of, it was semi uneven ground, but it would have taken so much effort to set the whole thing up that it was, like he was the guy that would move one stone with one finger, with one hand, basically a big one, because he would put it on a rock basically and give it a pivot point.
We're talking about Wally Wallington?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Hold on. Yeah, I'm just now figuring out. I thought we were talking about Coral Castle.
No, you're fine. Yes.
Forgive me. I didn't get a lot of sleep last night, so I am running low. So forgive me. So just all right, let me clarify my point here. I was talking about Coral Castle and that guy allegedly using levitation to move the stones and he died with the secret. Wally Wallington is the brilliant man that showed that you could move these 20 ton stones by balancing and everything, and it's genius. That guy, I mean, I really love it. I will say I don't find that it's a acceptable explanation for how the Egyptians moved 70 to 80 ton stones from 500 miles away up until the King's Chamber, because, you know, Wally was doing things on a concrete foundation. He was using pressurized water, you know, a hose so I'm like, there's a lot of things that if we were to talk about moving stones up the pyramid, you know, there could be some things in his theory that don't explain it move, you know, over 500 miles. But that aside, that stuff is genius and I love it. So forgive me for being completely turned around on what we were talking about.
It's all right. I'm glad that you're able to weigh in on it properly. Now, yeah. Yeah, the Coral Castle is interesting stuff, but yeah, sadly he did die with most of that stuff intact.
And that's the thing that makes.
Just a quick thanks to Isaiah Bailey. Appreciate it very much.
Nice. There was a comment a little further up. It wasn't a super chat, but it was professional biologist. He said, "My mom and Jimmy Corsetti were the two main reasons I got into the archaeology degree." I'm like, dude, that's wild. Nice. That's wild. I like comments like that. Professional biologist, we need you to, you know, come out of the woodwork once you get this degree and debunk the whole academic book right in front of everybody. Please, we need you.
Yeah, the Coral Castle was an interesting one. The eyewitness accounts were kind of kooky and stuff, but a lot of his stuff was like, a lot of it was electrical. Like looking at it, like he was building motors and shit there. They were big.
Oh,
but like he had like copper windings around big wooden spools and stuff, and they're like, I don't know what he's doing with it. And it's like, yeah, I know, it's a fucking motor that he had over there, man. He had some mechanical means to move some of this shit. I'm pretty certain.
Yeah, yes, there's no doubt in my mind because he. Just to clarify, he claimed levitation, right? That's the story.
That's what a lot of people say. Like the eyewitness accounts that was stuck with me the most. And I haven't dug into Ellis, so this could be like a bullshit account, even. But supposedly, when he had the place relocated, right? Like he had the place completely moved, and supposedly when he had it relocated, the movers, like he would have them park the van, turn their backs, and then he'd tell them okay, and then he'd turn back around, and the stone was on the flatbed. So okay. It was quick.
So, in other words, when this guy who had claimed that he had these special abilities, and then he dies with the secret, he can go screw himself. He's full of shit. You know, that's what I think. You know, that's the way I think. And if, like, because think about it, he didn't show anybody. So even if he did have, look, I don't believe him, if I'm being honest. It sounds like BS. But even if it was true, he did a tremendous disservice to humanity by dying with the secret. But where did the technology go after he died? Once he became a corpse and he died in his sleep or however he passed away, rest his soul, did anyone look in his shed during the estate sale? You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. Where is it? Right? You know what I mean? Like, this doesn't add up. So, no, I don't believe it. And this is no disrespect to anybody in the chat that loves the Coral Castle thing. I'm just sharing my honest opinion, which is that I think it's BS. And it makes me mad because I don't like BS in this field because it diminishes from the real mysteries and stuff, you know, when it gets brought into. Just like aliens. And hey, look, it's totally possible aliens came here and built the pyramid. We don't know who built the pyramid. I don't think it was aliens, but like I'll entertain something that's possible. But that guy, yeah. So anyway, don't get me going. I'm wound up now. I'm awake now.
you're all good. It is a funny story. It's frustrating too that because when people get invested into these things and the way that people are so polarized nowadays, I mean I run into this all the time where I can debunk something and say that but because I've debunked something that even though it's like that where it seems like super easy to address. People still get like
that was a zin I put in my mouth, by the way, sorry.
No, you're right. Sure it was.
It's gum.
they get all upset and think that it's like you're just a debunker and you can't like I saw there was one video that the Y-Files where AJ says that he's not trying to debunk everybody's favorite theories. But if we debunk 95% of them and the 5% that are left are a whole lot cooler, aren't they? And that's kind of how I look at it is that, you know, there's a lot of these ideas that get thrown out with little evidence, an observation and just a quick hypothesis that don't get fleshed out. And if the skeptics get cynical about it, then they don't even bother looking into them. And if they don't bother looking into them properly, then they just leave those things to just basically hang out there and not get looked into. And I know that sounds crazy, but you go back historically, science hasn't gone out of its way to call these things racist or white supremacy. It's gone out of its way to debunk these things. Look at mesmerism is one of the very first examples. I think it was a double blind study with them. Their belief that you can't just dilute water and eventually make it magic. and science addressed that. They didn't say these guys are a bunch of fucking idiots and they hate brown people. They said, okay, let's get us all in a room. Let's sit the fuck down. Let's fucking do this. Like, wrong answer, boys. And those guys nowadays won't. Now the answer is, to quote Dr. Miano, if it looks like a duck, I hope you understand. Well, okay, I don't understand. I understand that's the attitude of a YouTuber, not a fucking scientist. So I can get worked up about these things too, man. I for some reason, scientists that erroneously portray information or fail fundamentally to do their job, I feel like they're just like traitors to humanity in just like this horrible way. I know it sounds, some people think I'm crazy that way for thinking that, but I think we give them money and accolades and respect, and when they piss all over that by just pumping their ego and blowing smoke up our ass, I feel like they're fuck two steps away from an Epstein Island fucking frequenter. I mean, horrible fucking people.
Yeah, when I look at academics that are like extremely woke and liberal and stuff, and they're influencing the youth and poisoning their minds with like Marxism and other things, it is extremely detestable, and I feel like it should be stopped in some way. Like the field of academia has been overridden with hardcore liberals. And I'm not talking about whatever liberalism was 10, 15 years ago. I'm not talking about equal rights. I'm not talking about, you know, legalization of weed or some shit. Like, I'm talking about like a woke Marxism, emerging growing of Marxism. But we don't have to get down that. That's a darker tangent. But like, you know, anyway, God, don't get me going.
You're just fine. I try to steer away from politics. I'm very, very middle of the road. Like I did mention earlier about the QAnon shaman thing. And it's always funny to me to see those people complain about the scientists, the hardcore left wingers complain about that year and the storming of the White House and say this is a threat to our democracy. And it's like, as a guy who lives in Washington State, that same year we had the whole Chaz Chop thing, and that was also a threat to our democracy. It's the same exact thing. You are using violence to subvert the fucking democratic process. I you might have whatever reason you have behind it, but you don't have. This is a non-political take. This is fundamentally, you are using violence to subvert democracy. So if you ignore one of the, in my opinion, if you ignore one of these and say one of these is justifiable and the other's not, you probably, in my opinion, you shouldn't fucking vote. But that's a conversation for a different video.
Right. You know, real quick, you mentioned the QAnon shaman, as he's called. I forgot his real name, but I know it. But I met him. I was at America First conference. I was invited to here in Phoenix last. I think it was November or December. And last year, and he was there, and you know, everyone's getting pictures with him, and I chatted with him, and he was extremely lucid and smart, and very, as you mentioned, like he follows Graham Hancock's work, and it turns out that he knew my channel, and I chatted with him for a bit, and what that guy is completely different than the way the media portrayed him. He was dressed up like a wildling, wearing that freaking barbarian, whatever you call it, the Viking hat, and you know, shirtless and all that other stuff. And like, but if you talk to him, his IQ, like he's a smart guy and very inquisitive and very down to earth. Very surprising to a lot of people when you chat with him. In fact, I think Tucker Carlson had actually interviewed him when he first got out of jail after he was locked up for a few months, and which was completely unjust because like the videos proved that like he was escorted. Like the guards led him around. He shouldn't have been in there in the first place. Like people that got nixed in the Capitol, like that's a whole, I don't want to go down that topic, but like one, they shouldn't be in prison as they still are without trial, but we don't need to go down there. I'm just trying to say that I met him and he was really nice.
Yeah, no, you're fine. You're fine. Thanks. Yay politics.
Jacob Chansley. Someone said it. I am perplexed. Sorry to interrupt. Jacob Chansley. Sorry. I dreaded not remembering his name. I know his name. Forgive me.
No, you're fine. I'm glad that somebody remembered it. Yeah, it's hilarious the way that I am really not a fan of the way the culture war has infested this whole thing. And that's, I mean, you can kind of smell my politics by the way that my channel is, where I'm so firmly in the middle that when I watch most things happen politically, I just sit there and shake my head. I just right. sit there. I'm watching. It's. I feel like I'm in the UK watching a fucking soccer match and watching the two sides fight about it. It's like you guys. I ask people all the time, and I'll say it right now I'm sure I will offend some people in the chat with this, but I'm sorry. Not sorry. Fucking not sorry. If you've got this right. crazy, like, hardcore political opinion, you're like all the time, like, blah, blah, blah. If you can't fucking name your local politicians, the people that have the real power over whether or not your county has legal alcohol, fucking tobacco, the price, like, all the basic shit. If you can't name your local politicians and your local laws, you're just a fucking casual and you probably shouldn't vote. You're ill-informed and you're being led around as a sheep. And a lot of people don't like that because they just want to focus on the two dickheads that fight for the White House. And that's where most people, 80, 90% of the people that are into politics are mouth-breathing boneheads. I know I just pissed a lot of people off, but sorry.
It's true, though. Most people get their news from just skimming headlines. I made this joke on another podcast a while back where I said that, like, I'm serious. Most people are getting their news while they're sitting on the toilet in a bathroom stall on their work break, going through their phone like this, scrolling through headlines, not reading the articles and coming to conclusions, and their brain is being poisoned by the mainstream media. The mainstream media is totally corrupt. They are all multinational corporations that are being influenced from countries around the world, which is bizarre. And if you do any bit of research on the things they talk about, it's seldom the truth. Like, you got to go to the source now. So, like, I remember when Trump was in office and I was really paying attention to the COVID stuff when it was first taking off. And I remember the media just eviscerating him. Yet I was watching all of the press conferences when it first happened because I was trying to figure out what's going on and ascertain things. And I remember noticing how I thought at that time it would waken up a lot of people to see how corrupt the media was against him and that they were completely not portraying the things he was saying accurately at all. They were just doing everything they could to smear him. I'm like, did you listen to the press conference I listened to? Like, did you hear what he said? Anyway, so just, you know, not to go down that path, but like to iterate that, like, people are not taking upon themselves to inform themselves is my main point here. And it is a travesty because these people are voters.
Yeah. it's boring stuff. Reading something is boring and long. Okay, it takes a long time to read something. It's one of these papers they put on cap. Oh, we're going to pass a bill. It's 300 pages. Fucking, it's tedious. It's long, but it's really easy to take what. So Joe Blow that says that you follow them on Twitter, you follow them on YouTube, and they talk about politics. They sit there on Twitch all day long talking to the chat about politics, 6 hours, right. 10 hours a day. And this guy's and all they do is they're meme lords, basically. They press emotional buttons and turn these things into low-level sound bites. Like, a great example that you could see in our community, which isn't political, but it's a perfect example of that, was when Hancock was banned from filming at Serpent Mound. And he says in Ancient Apocalypse, I was banned from Serpent Mound. And then right afterwards, he says, I was allowed on the site, but I wasn't allowed to film. That I was banned from Serpent Mound became a sound bite. And there's videos on YouTube of people asking, hey, did you guys ban Graham Hancock? Oh, no. Ha ha. Proves he was a liar. It's like, listen to the next sentence, you dickhead. Well, they didn't watch it. Somebody handed them a sound bite. And they think that they've got some gotcha. Now, that's the way that culture runs right now. Flint Dibble saying, running with Graham Hancock, saying there's no evidence for Atlantis, when he's saying in the underwater archaeology, there's no evidence for Atlantis. That's what Hancock specifically was referencing. But Flint, we got Hancock here saying no evidence for Atlantis. And then all these dickheads that didn't watch the fucking debate, or even half of them that did, but they got the attention of a squirrel. I can get worked up too.
Well, let's do it. Like, brother, they were so disingenuous to use that clip. They removed the context. Graham acknowledges there's no evidence of a lost lost civilization, whatever. It's like the context was key, and that's not what Graham was saying. He was talking about in the context of what they said, like, you know, that there wasn't some sort of thing found that definitively proved that, you know, there was this lost civilization in the context of the things that they had already discussed. Like, it wasn't. Anyone that watched the full thing that has a brain would understand that, and they ran with it. One of the other things, I mean, this is kind of out of left field, but I want to mention it.
Yeah.
Because certain people, in the aftermath following the Hancock-Flint-Dibble debate on Rogan, a lot of people were saying on the internet, and on X, people, and I won't name names, but there was people recirculating saying, go look at the Reddit comments. Everyone says that Flint won and Graham got obliterated. And go look at the Reddit comments. And they were literally copy and pasting the links to the Reddit things. And this is something that I have to mention. Reddit is trash. And I hope someone unplugs it. let me tell you something. I am no longer on Reddit. It's been a few years since I've been on, and I decided to get off of it after I was banned from the Joe Rogan subreddit by their moderators. Let me just say, Joe Rogan nor his team has any affiliation of any capacity with his Reddit page. I don't know how many other guests have been on his show that have put their work on that subreddit. I'm not saying I was the only one, but I imagine it's kind of very few people that take it upon themselves to go on there and do it that have been on the show. And brother, they banned me. They didn't like my work. And to be full disclosure, I was a video about it. It was an economic doomsday video saying that the crash of the US dollar is going to happen, which it will. I predicted early and was wrong in that regard, but it's coming. Like the removal of the petrodollar is going away. BRICS is emerging. The collapse of the US dollar is imminent. Anyway, but they banned me, and I was like, are you serious? Like, so with that being said, before I went on Rogan the first time, my brother told me ahead of time, he's like, bro, don't read the comments afterwards on Reddit. I was like, why? I wasn't really on Reddit at that time, or at least not doing much. And he's like, go take a look at the subreddit. Every single time they have a guest come on Joe Rogan's show, it's like the entire subreddit hates Rogan and hates every single one of his guests. It's really weird. So I went and looked. I took a gander for myself, and I was astonished to see that that was a fact. Go look on the subreddits for any guests they bring on, and it's overwhelmingly negative. It's almost like there's a bunch of plants in there that, and I'm not saying they're getting paid to do it, but like there's people with motivation to tarnish every single guest that's on that show ever. It's actually very weird, and the fact I was banned says a lot. So with that being said, the fact that people were, including people with PhDs that are academic lecturers and associate professors that were promoting the subreddit on Reddit for that debate, saying that Graham Hancock lost and Flint obliterated him. I'm like, you could not have come up with a more biased source. I would encourage people to use the YouTube comments as a far more reliable one, even though we both know that on both of our channels it's going to be overwhelmingly positive. But when you get someone controversial on a Joe Rogan podcast, and you go look through those comments, oh, they'll be very balanced. You'll see good and bad, and they'll be all over the place. Even overwhelmingly bad, or could be overwhelmingly good, depending on the nature of the guest and the conversation. But like, it is far more fair than Reddit, where they literally are able to bury comments. It's actually pretty spectacular on the algorithms of that site, because I've experienced it, brother. I have a little experience in the social media game, and I've learned what works and what doesn't work. I've been able to make some things go viral and many things crash and fail in the process. And I have seen that there is something going on with them burying comments on Reddit that are substantial or positive. Like, it's very wild. So enough about that. I talk too much, and so forgive me for that. But like,
come on, buddy, you're fine.
I'm trying to say, fuck Reddit.
Yes.
Okay. If you're on there, anyone on there, delete your account. Like, you got to take a stand. Like, that that place is corrupt.
I quit using Reddit. The Graham Hancock subreddit, I went there at first and was like talking to people and promoting my channel and stuff when I first started, and that went okay. But it very quickly, people there value their opinions extremely highly, and they don't understand something. And this is something that I try to explain pretty regularly. Okay. Monkeys communicate one monkey at a time. They groom each other, right? And then humans, we evolved this ability to talk. So we can communicate with 1,000 of each other at a time. And so I've got a platform that I use to try to talk to thousands of people at a time. I'm not going to get into it multiple comments over and over with one person like we're fucking monkeys grooming each other. I'm sorry. I didn't work to build this channel to fucking sit around and argue with individuals. And boy, oh boy, on Reddit, that's just an admission of guilt. You're a fuck. And one more thing really quick. Like, you talk about the Joe Rogan group banning you and stuff. The vast majority of groups for Joe Rogan, Graham Hancock, Atlantis, and all this stuff are moderated by people who they set these up as honeypots. They want to make fun of the people that like Graham Hancock. So they I just left a group on Facebook for exactly that reason. It's like, man, I am fucking fed up with this shit. You have your have your little groups. I'm not even going to participate in that shit. That's so pathetically child. Can you imagine? Like, imagine starting a group that was like, I love the NRA, and then bashing everybody that came there for liking the NRA. It's like, why in the fuck? What the fuck do you do with your life? What is wrong with you? So, but anyway.
You know, that reminds me, as far as like finding a place with fair comments, I noticed X, formerly known as Twitter, is the place for it, because negative comments will get a bunch of likes too. You'll at least see it, and they're not being buried. Like, certain comments can get buried if they're super negative, but like, well, actually, I can't even say that. There's super negative comments that don't get buried. So, like, x.com seems to be heading in a really good way path. And, hey, could you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Well, let's read this super chat. And then afterwards, could you put the comment by, it's just scroll up a smidgen. It's Crafty Sasquatch, where he's calling me a sellout. I want to address it. But let's address the super chat first.
Okay. Everything you guys said about, Rubate, he's right. This is the paper I was telling you about, and this is the user I was telling you about. He sent me a link to that paper that is Vegans, Dibble, and Hoops, and it's damn near a fucking manifesto, man. It's gross. Okay, so what was the name of the person that left you the comments?
Crafty Sasquatch, and it starts off with saying, hey, Jimmy, do you think Dan needs to make a living? Notice he isn't a sellout and has ads every 10 minutes. Jimmy the sellout. And I was going to say, hey, guys, I'll address it. Like, I don't mind addressing negative stuff. Like, first of all, I do sponsors with Rumble, and the deal I have with Rumble allows, it's like a win-win for both of us. We partner with having some sponsors that we agree upon, and they promote my channel, and I make a living doing it. And this is how I make my living. In my videos, I don't feel like I put too many ads, but maybe on the live streams I could cut it back. I have it set to do one ad every 18 minutes, which I don't think is unreasonable. But hey, you know, you got to make a living, guys. I still have student loans from me going to grad school, and so I got to do what I got to do. But don't call me a sellout, because like, there's no company I would represent if it's not a product I would buy myself, and nobody controls me. And to be crystal clear, every sponsor that I do, there's a prerequisite, which is that I can say anything I want on my video. There's no approval. There's no nothing. It's either, if you want me to read your product, it's freedom of speech, baby. And every single company is like that, that Rumble markets. So, you know, I'm not a sellout, but hey, you got to make a buck. Hey, it is. Have you seen grocery store prices? It's $20 for a steak, $20 for beef.
Well, I'll say really quickly, if I had enough of a view count and subscriber base that I would get solicited with ads, I would definitely be running them. You see all the Sega Saturn and the Xbox shit, the Sega Genesis game just laying here under the fucking computer. Hmm. You can expect Raid Shadow Legends ads, motherfuckers. They are coming. I'll be telling you how great it'll be to play Raid Shadow Legends, and then I'll make my son play it.
I love it.
Point is, I agree with you. You have to make, like, you have to be able to make a buck on this. Like, there came a time here recently where I got to, one of my followers started making sure that ends were going to be met and all of that stuff so that I could dedicate more time, and the ad revenue got higher. And if you want, okay, it's one thing if you want me to come out and make a video once a week and I put what I can into it or I don't. But if like, you want content creators to regularly be part of the community, generate content, know what's going on in the community and all that shit, follow the news. However, you guys got to fucking eat, man. Like you said, beef isn't cheap. Even ramen isn't cheap anymore.
You know, something to be said as well as when it comes to the ads, if you don't monetize your channel, YouTube will automatically monetize it and take all the earnings from it, and they will run more ads. And also, like, let's just be real, every video has ads on it, whether you like it or not. Some have more or less than others, obviously. But the reality is that this is part of the game, and like, you and I are both in the trade of teaching people. Like, we're informing, we're doing research on interesting topics and sharing it with others. And somebody sitting through a 50 or 15 second ad, you know, I'm not the one charging them, you know, 20 or God, whatever tuition is, depending on the university, 20,000 a year, 100,000, you know, God, you know, egregiously overpriced prices. And so I think that's worth mentioning.
Well, Crafty Sasquatch, that's great. If you decide to unsubscribe from me, then that's your thing. And yes, Uncharted X probably runs no ads. But here's the thing, man. I'm a single dad, and the second they let me run ads, I will put ads on my videos. Now, if that's a hard thing for you, I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. Again, people have got to make a dollar. Like, I'll tell you, it's one of the funniest things that I've seen in more recent years is like the talk about, like, musicians have really took a hit. Like Don Henley, if you listen to him, he'll bitch to no end about how his you know, the 10% of the royalties they used to get 20 years ago because of YouTube, basically, because the monetization model is put it on some cloud and let the kids download it for a few pennies, or put it on YouTube and make a few pennies every time somebody watches it.
Yeah.
And it's like, these guys still need to make money. Look at what that's done to music. Stop and think for a second. Name one band that's big right now. I guess Maroon 5, I suppose, maybe, but from 10 years ago. But like right now, it's all individual artists because there's no money in supporting a band anymore. And they make so little money that they're not going to support this big group of people. They'll support one person and put them in front of the same house musicians over and over again. The record companies have been dying to have that model work for them for decades, and now that the purse strings got smaller. My point is, if you fucking steal all the money or make it where people that are content creators can't make a dollar without getting bitched at by their viewers, then you'll end up with content creators that are either already wealthy or that make content once or twice a year, and either one of those sounds like you're culling most of the herd. So,
yeah,
short time.
I don't care about the money part of it. Some people get all wound up, and I'm like, I'm curious, like, what their profession is. Like, if you were making a living off of doing what I'm doing, how would you make that living? So I don't even care. Like, some people have this guilty conscience about monetizing their channel, and I'm like, I just think it's so silly because, again, YouTube, was it a year or two ago that they enacted their change where it's like, if you don't monetize your channel, they will monetize it and keep 100%. So the ads are there on every video, and they're making more money than ever by doing it. It's an eight, and by the way, 15-second video or video ads are not comparable to 3 to 4 minutes of ads on some mainstream network television show of obnoxious commercials. So I don't care. Like, I think I'll defend it, but like, most people don't give a shit, and I don't even know why I even focused on that comment. I just want to address the sellout part. But, you know, the reality is that, like, those comments talking about ads are few and far between.
Yeah. David Stig Hansen said that he had a bourbon and a ribeye. And
I saw that. I love
Mark
it.
Lemon says, take this so Crafty Sasquatch can just leave. All right.
I love
Look
it.
Look at that. See that? Now we've got our ad revenue. Yeehaw. it's funny. I can understand, like, being a little bit frustrated by the thing for some people. Like, if it's constant... It is frustrating sometimes when you sit down and watch a video and the guy gives you a 2-minute spiel of an ad and then it jumps straight to a commercial after that. But again, like you said, it's nothing compared to watching it on TV or anything. And like the income difference, it's like, I think a lot of these guys just think that, like, you get a YouTube video that gets 10,000 views and next thing you know, like, you just got this golden ticket. You walk in anywhere and you get, it's like, dude, I'm still making less money than I did 20 years ago as an electrician, and that's not accounting for inflation. So calm your tits there, people.
Crafty Sasquatch followed up with, social media streaming is a hobby, not a fucking career. You can pretend it's a career, but it never will be. I beg to differ. I make more money doing this than I made as a fraud investigator, and it's allowed me to travel to unique places around the world. And I like working for myself, and it's good. And to be honest, there are ways I could make a lot more money doing this that I have chosen not to do, because I don't want to pollute my own brand or my YouTube channel. So it's pretty funny. It's like, hey, you know, being a content creator, and Dan, as your success continues to grow, what you just said will no longer be the truth. You'll be making more money than you were as an electrician. And I think it's going to happen sooner than you think. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. Because, like, for me, and I know there's people listening that can identify with this, that like the grind of a 9-to-5 and being told what to do all the time can take its toll, and it wasn't the kind of life that I enjoyed. I'd rather be the boss. You know, it's just my mindset. Like, no, I'll tell you, I know what's best. I'll tell you what to do. You know what I mean? Like, I'm tired. I've had enough. I had some great bosses in my life that influenced me greatly, but I did have too many that I didn't think were great at what they did. And it sucks your soul. You know what I mean? And like driving into work when you know, it's like, so, you know, I encourage more people to go down the social media route because like, again, look at X.com. I'm making money on there now where I wasn't before Elon had taken over. And it's an opportunity for you to reach many millions of new people that would otherwise not see your work at all. Social media is the public square now. It is not the mainstream network television, and it's not the universities anymore. Tuitionship is down in many places, and it's going to continue to go down. And so, you know, the online realm is where we're living, and everyone else is just a dinosaur if they don't get that.
I have to agree with you there. A couple super chats here real quick. Benjamin Farrell says, I never got to pay the people I liked on FTA TV and sometimes got to question the creator, and I have them respond. Thank you for your time, Dan and Jimmy. Yes, thank you, Benjamin. And Local Enterprise Broadcasting, agree about the ban period, but Power Trio still make money, no, from experience. Yes, they do, but they don't exactly do well when you're talking about, like, we're talking about new bands. You start talking about new bands being brought out, you don't really see bands anymore. Like, if you go to the bar, you're going to see a band, usually. But
right.
Then your new artists that get signed, I mean, just go look at the top 40. And even your country artists nowadays are all single names. They're like, I can't think of one band that's come out in the last 5 years.
Right.
I get a huge amount of value from each of you. YouTube is free. Stop bitching. Thanks.
I love that.
Hallelujah to that.
I love it. I love that comment. I saw it too. But, you know, this is fun, like, you know, being able to talk about these topics and bring them to, you know, new eyes and to where people wouldn't have known about these things otherwise. It's very fulfilling. Being able to have a stage where you could reach potentially millions of people is a very, very unique and special thing. And I take great pride in it. Like, I have brought certain topics to people's awareness that others weren't aware. Like, all right, so the Göbekli Tepe situation, and this isn't a toot my horn thing. This is something that I'm proud of, that like no one was talking about the issues of the trees or the pullback of excavations before I brought it to light. And I may not have discovered Göbekli Tepe, obviously, but like bringing the issues of archaeology is obviously part of the role that I know in the calling that I'm feeling to play. I may have studied business, but it's allowed me to understand that, like, if there's inefficiencies happening, it's, you know, it's not only fixable, it's a problem, but it is it should be fixable. And if it's not, you got the wrong people in place. And having a passion for the mysteries of, our true ancient origins, and seeing that there is a bizarre pullback on finding these answers is just something that I find to be passionate about. It gets me going. And I would like to see more people take on and bring out these mysteries. Like, you know, you can't have too many teachers out there, at least good ones.
No, I couldn't argue with that more. I mean, I really appreciate a lot of the work that you did. I was watching you years ago when I just got custody of my kid and didn't have a whole lot of time for it, but I would sit down and watch the occasional YouTube video and catch your content from time to time. A lot of that stuff's long, long, long gone stuff that you've like you've looked at and you're like, yeah, I think I'm better than that now. But I was still watching it. And so, yeah, man, you've been part of the scene for quite a bit. But I should probably wrap this up soon. It's almost 9:00. I've got this kid to get ready for bed and stuff. And
right on.
Probably be a dad. Yeah. Thanks so much for taking the time, Jim. I really appreciate it, man.
Dude, my pleasure. Thank you for coming on my show and then now coming on yours. I'm grateful. And let's do it again. Your channel or mine next time, whatever we want to do. But every time we have a conversation, I really enjoy it. And I think I can tell that the engagement, people are enjoying it as well. We've got a lot of nice comments. Yeah. And so we should do it again sometime soon. In fact, let's be real. Here's what's coming up. Ancient Apocalypse comes out on October. It's either October 15th or October 16th. I want to say the 16th. Yep. So we both know that there will be a firestorm afterwards. That's what happened 2 years ago when the first season came out, and it was a hot topic if there ever was one. And that's where vicious accusations came out towards Graham Hancock involving racism, white supremacy, and all this other crap. And something tells me things will get heated again. And I sense that you and I could have a fun, spirited conversation about the aftermath of that in the coming weeks. So we should circle back maybe later this month and kind of get address the tempo of the situation, because I'm sure there'll be a tempo.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it will definitely be something fun to discuss. So, yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a plan. I appreciate it.
Well, right on, brother. Thanks for having me on. And thank you to everybody that joined in tonight. This was a lot of fun. And thank you guys all for the support. And always a pleasure, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Really quick, Joshua. Yes, I am talking to Geoff. He is going to be on my channel here soon to explain his theory. Basically like this, where I haven't looked at the whole thing. I'm going to have him on. So with that,
he's wonderful.
I will say goodbye. Yeah, he's really
I like
cool
Land of Chem. Talk. Yeah, wonderful, wonderful guy.
Have some more money. Okay, well, thanks. Being sellout. Appreciate it, guys. Yes, and right. David Stig Hansen, in 2 days, you are coming on the channel, and he's visiting the Ride Shot.
Nice.
All right. Thank
Hell
you all
yeah.
so very much. Have a great evening. We will see you guys next time. Thanks again, Jim.
Thanks again, Dan.